welcome to the CWF Gamecast, soon to be called the Monty and the Fox Wargaming Show. I'm your co-host, Tom Barbalay, and today I'm joined once again by Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. It's been a few weeks. You've had some, like, zombie flu or something. Are you still mumbling brains to yourself, or are you back in full form?
Well, I'm doing much better now, but it's actually funny because I have, and I don't know why I have this, but I have, like, you know those little, stress balls that they make? I have one of those that's in the shape of a brain. It's a blue brain. So the other day, out of nowhere, I grabbed it and I started gnawing on this. My wife was like, you really did turn into a zombie.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I think come the zombie apocalypse, probably the wargamers are going to be the first to go, unfortunately. Because, you know, we're the ones with the brains that they want, and then after that it'll kind of progressively go down to the remainder of the population. But anyway, so on tonight's show, we have both Jonathan and my account of the Black Powder rules. Now, we've both given separate reviews of Black Powder, but this is the first time we will actually be jamming together on this very podcast associated with Black Powder. Jonathan has a problem with battle games on the iPad. Now, I recorded a little spot for... Well, I didn't record. I wrote a little spot for Battle Games magazine associated with the iPad. I'm still not sure if they'll actually use that, but that's an aside. Boom Studios 40K GNs. What are GNs?
Graphic novels. It's a little abbreviation.
Okay, very good, very good. I'm clearly not qualified to co-host this podcast. Jonathan's appearance on Gatestormers and Pandemic, and your wife has been painting. Oh, that's very good news. That's very good news. All in your week in gaming. You have some Osprey book reviews in relation to Black Powder. I have some book reviews. I have a couple of iPhone app iPhone app reviews fitting in with the whole iPad kind of digital technology. And, yeah, just general ramblings. And we've got a couple of contests to talk about as well, Jonathan.
We do.
Terrific. So I'm not even sure when this podcast is going to be released. So it's probably 3 weeks ago, week in wargaming, but you've recently discovered the Black Powder rules. I know I had some. I think it was before you got sick that you first discovered it. So it seems like I've been communicating with you for the past maybe 3 weeks associated with Black Powder, and I listened to your recorded podcast on Black Powder. But how's it all going? You're actually painting stuff currently.
I know. I think that's more astonishing to me than it is to anyone else.
Clearly you did get the zombie flu. I think this is a clear indication that this is not the same Jonathan J. Reinhardt of previous podcasts.
There's something that, like, if people don't know me, this one thing more than anything else in the world that you have to understand is that I do not like to paint, I do not like to assemble, I am awful at both, and if you actually see me doing either one, it's either my doppelganger or I took some sort of New Year's resolution or something, or like it has to be fantastic. Because I just don't do it. It takes me forever. I don't like what I do. I'm not good at it. And unfortunately, most of the games I like, they require some sort of assembly or painting. So it ends up being, I get really excited, and then I realize I actually have to sit down and paint these hunks of plastic and pewter, and then I shelf the game for a while.
But you have actually legitimately, I mean, for folks listening in, my candid advice to Jonathan was that he should go out, and I think I've said this in a podcast that people may have heard already by this point, but he should go out and buy a pre-assembled, pre-painted army, preferably either from a deceased estate or through one of these flea markets that seem to be going at these games conventions, because my anticipation was, and in fact, you've gone further than I anticipated you would get, Jonathan, so hats off to you. How many have you painted? Have you painted 12 or 24 so far?
Well, right now I have trousers done on 6 of them.
Very good.
Which is 6 more trousers than I thought I would ever paint.
Very good. I'm sure there's a joke somewhere, but I'm not touching any of that. Okay, so moving on from that. But I guess, and if we want to get into the Black... Do we want to just digress into a discussion associated with Black Powder and your week in wargaming?
I think we're already halfway there.
Okay, so let's digress. My feeling with the rules, and I think I probably gave a review of the rules relatively early on my time on this very podcast, was that I thought it required absolutely phenomenally large armies in order to play reasonable games of Black Powder. And certainly that's the feedback that I've received from everyone, including Henry Hyde, Neil Shook and a wide variety of other folk in the UK. And when I see the Black Powder battles online, when I see the photos appearing, typically in Neil Shook's more importantly, Henry Hyde's Facebook feed, it usually, you know, we're talking serious tablefuls of usually lead or occasionally well-painted plastic in order to get one of these games out. So when you first approached me, my advice to you was to save your money on the rule book and, like I say, buy one of these deceased estate armies. And you didn't take any of my advice.
No, I didn't. Honestly, I thought about it, and I did a little looking around on eBay. And I was like, oh, you know, if I see something, fine. But part of me just knows I wouldn't have been happy with how the models were painted. I would have, you know, looked and been like, you know, maybe someday I could perhaps do better. Or, barring that, I know people who could actually paint better than most things you would see on eBay. That
here's the timeout point, Jonathan. All those things aside, we're talking about you picking up a brush and a paint pot and applying it to about maybe 120 figures minimum in order to comply with the very minimum necessary to play Black Powder. And all that aside, at least you would have a painted army that you could then do touch-up work on or solicit a friend to do touch-up work on versus, I guess, what you're doing currently, which is... So another piece of advice that I gave you, I'm not even going to ask you if you even considered following this, was to start with cards and try playing a game just with cards, moving cards around to get a sense of the battle dynamics and these kind of things. Have you considered that at all?
I got to say, that didn't even enter my mind. No, I'll tell you why. If I'm going to play a miniatures game, I need to have miniatures. I prefer to play with miniatures that have paint on them. Notice yeah. I didn't say they were painted. You know, just have some paint on them. But I will play, if I have to, with miniatures that are unpainted, as long as they're assembled in on some sort of base or, you know, other required thing to hold them up. But I just can't bring myself to use bits of card or paper or, you know, tokens to represent the actual miniatures. Now, if it's a game that's not a miniatures game, I'm more than happy to do it because, I mean, perhaps that's what they intended. But clearly, like a game, whether it's like Black Powder or 40K or Hordes or whatever, part of it is having these 3D representations of you or your forces on that table.
I'm not going to fault you for that. I guess I'm not faulting you for that. My concern really is your relatively limited budget associated with this. And I guess out of all the possible games that exist today, I could be wrong. I mean, I'm sure there are like 54mm games that require probably $4,000 or $5,000 worth of figures. But Black Powder, by even my best assessment, even if you're buying the cheapest possible plastics or alternatively a deceased estate army, you're going to be laying down between $700 and probably $1,200 minimum.
Not me.
Just to get the play, you know, the play necessary. And you clearly came to, maybe you did, maybe I'm throwing ideas out there, but you came to this with some budget in mind. How did you, I mean, I'm just trying to think of the logic associated with what you're going to paint and play with for Black Powder. I mean, were you thinking 120 figures or were you thinking 50 figures initially? Or, I mean, what was your kind of scope associated with this feat?
Well, I think it's important to maybe take a step back. I got into the whole wargaming thing with, you know, 40K and with fantasy, and I've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on those stupid things. I painted, you know, hundreds of figures and tanks and stuff to have armies. My Tau army perhaps is the most comprehensive, but I also have a Chaos Warriors army for fantasy. You know, blocks of infantry and chariots, and I have a War Mammoth from Forge World that's in some state of assembly and painting. So it's not like I won't do this. It's just that it's unlikely that I would get into the desire to do it. But once I get into that mode, I can hold it for a while as long as my interest remains piqued. And that would continue if I'm actually involved with it. There are those around me who are participating in it and who will, you know, not only nurture me, but who will be working on it themselves. It just so happens that with Black Powder, there's at least one other individual who will be just starting it now, who also has a limited budget, so they will be doing a smaller army. And then there are two other individuals who play who have moderate-sized armies, but they're just happy enough to have other people to play against that they will gladly do smaller-sized games. I have no intention of any time in the near future, you know, having hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of models for Black Powder. I agree with you that I think it looks best, and perhaps it plays best, if you have a larger sized force. My experience is just based on my time reading the beginning of the rulebook and thumbing through it, looking at the pictures, and then looking at some of the Revolutionary War accounts of fighting in Battle Games Magazine. There was one, I think it was with Giles Allison, and it wasn't with the Black Powder rules, but it was with another rule set that they did early on. I think he was playing, Henry may have been keeping track of it, and I think the Perry brothers were involved, and perhaps Allie Morrison. And I can't remember which issue of Battle Games it was. It was an earlier issue. But anyway, they had the pictures, and they had, you know, these gigantic forces, and it looked fantastic. And, of course, I mean, that's what every gamer wants, but that's part of the whole, what I'm going to call, new gaming industry. They come up with all this new stuff, and they come up with new stuff every month, and they say you need to have the right table, it has to look the right way, and you have to have all this stuff. Otherwise, you're not a valid gamer, so you need to spend those thousands of dollars. And I don't think you actually have to. I think it's possible, whether it's Black Powder or another rule set, that I could have as much enjoyment playing with a smaller size force with other people who are doing the same kind of thing, just, you know, using it as a chance for us to get together, do something fun that we enjoy, you know, make a few memories, and then have a few laughs. I think I can do that with Black Powder, and I mean, I've done it with other games. I definitely agree Black Powder looks the best if you have more troops on the table. I probably will never end up getting there, but like my long-term goal, and when I say long-term, I mean, you know, within a couple of years, is to have a battalion of three regiments of infantry. We're talking 24 infantry per regiment, one artillery battery of 1 to 2 guns, and then a regiment of cavalry.
Okay, so that's roughly where I got my 120 number from, which seems to be what you're describing there.
Yeah, that would be, you know, a long-term goal. A more moderate goal would be to drop off the cavalry and then have one artillery piece or a battery, but keep the same number of infantry.
So I guess the advice that I got reading through here, and I'm trying to find the exact quote. I mean, thankfully that answer gave me an opportunity at least to skim through the book. But I'm trying to find the exact quote. I mean, the rules are originally designed for people who already have existing armies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my concern with regards to the Black Powder rule set, which is why, aside from the fact that it's a very beautiful coffee table book, and I am interested in some of the conflicts that it covers, the only way that I would get into Black Powder is under the conditions that I've described, associated with either going to Historicon 1 year. Unfortunately, it probably won't be this year, maybe next year, and or one of these amazing conventions in the UK, and buying either a deceased estate army or an army that was available at a flea market. My estimate was that you needed at minimum, and I'm trying to see if that was actually a quote here, that you need at minimum 120, and I know you've been through this more recently and probably with a more eagle eye, but I thought 120 was kind of like the bare minimum for coherent play.
Well, they give a citation, I guess you would call it, on the number of models that you would have for sizes of units, and most of your units would be what they call a standard size. So for infantry, that's anywhere between 24 to 30 models. Cavalry, it's 12 to 16 models. And then artillery, it's one gun plus its crew.
Certainly.
And they say in this, and I think it's somewhere in the beginning, but they say that you very, very rarely will have, you know, a tiny unit or a small unit. That's going to be some sort of skirmishers or scouts. And you're also very, very rarely to have a larger unit, which would be something like a 36 or 40, I think, infantry, you know, like 18 or so cavalry or whatever. So by and large, you're going to have the 24 to 30 models for infantry, less, well, a dozen or so for cavalry and so forth.
Yeah.
So if you figure that, and I don't think they actually give a breakdown on, you know, how many regiments you should have per battalion or whatever, but if you figure that you're going to do what I'm doing, where you're going to have the three regiments for one battalion, you get the easy math there. So I think that would give you that low ball bottom limit for where you need to start. Could you play with one regiment? I'm sure you could. Would you have a lot of fun? Probably not.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my reading of the rules, and I'm just trying to see, because they think, yeah, you're right, the general vagary of the rules, which I'm now refreshing myself with, doesn't indicate minimums in terms of actual playability. But the way in which these units are used in the game seems to indicate that you would need, well, probably in the order of at least 10 minimum. I mean, you might get away with kind of 6 in an early game of these units, of, as you've described, depending on what they are, between 10 to 30 models, or in the case of artillery, as you say, smaller. But I guess my sense of the rules, and certainly the descriptions of the rules, seems to indicate that, well, I mean, I guess what you're doing is extremely ambitious. Let's just put it that way. I'm not going to argue with you anymore, Jonathan, associated with this, because ultimately, as you've described, there is a half-assembled mammoth somewhere which may be pining for a little bit of extra glue and paint as we talk.
Well, I think the other thing, too, in my situation, which perhaps is unique, as I said, there's two other people who already have armies, so to speak, and one other person who's creating an army. Now, between the four of us, would be perfectly able to do team games. One of the people who has an army is doing Redcoats. The other one is doing, you know, official American colonial infantry. I'm doing basically American militia. And then the other person who's just getting into it is doing Hessians. So not only would it make fluff sense to combine, you know, the Hessians and the Redcoats and the colonial militia with the others, but it would work for game sense. I mean, not only would we all get along, but we can just jive and put our units together so we could play a smaller-ish game where, like, say, I would be a half or a fourth of our coalition force, and then the other side would be equitable.
Yeah.
And since the others have more models, they can make up the difference, at least until, you know, we grow into whatever particular point we go to. I could probably say with almost definitive certainty, I'm not going to end up having, you know, 10 regiments of 30 infantry each, or, you know, whatever. Besides a monetary issue, I mean, it's just a space situation. I have my parents' attic filled with Warhammer 40K and fantasy stuff.
Yes.
Those of you who have or who may end up listening to the Gatestormers podcast, which I know we're going to talk about later on, but my friend Drew, he interviewed me, and one of the things we talked about was, you know, how this takes up so much space and where all my stuff is, and most of it's at my parents in the basement or the attic. And of course, eventually that needs to come out and go somewhere else. But that's, you know, what the whole saving for a house is for. Well, partly. But don't tell my wife, no.
Okay, well, following this line, you've been able to get your wife to actually do some painting for you.
Well, she's getting there. What it actually is, and I consider this a lot of progress. We went to the Wiz. It's up on Route 9 in Westboro, Route 9 East. And we actually had a Groupon. For those of you not familiar with Groupon, you pay X amount, usually half of the cost of, they call it a coupon, but it's basically a gift certificate. So we have like a $20 gift certificate for the Wiz, and we paid $10 to get this $20 gift certificate. So we got that, and we ended up going to the Wiz recently, and we were looking around, and it's a great gaming store. I highly recommend going to it. It's worth making a trip to, especially if you're into Flames of War. They have every single Flames of War model that a local game store could obtain. It's all in stock, and if it's not, it will be coming in stock shortly, because they order it all, they get it all in. I don't know how they do it, but they have everything. It's amazing. So if you're into Flames of War in particular, they have tons of stuff, but of course they carry, you know, other things. 40K, they carry D&D, and like they have a lot of chess sets and board games. Anyway, we went up there, and we had to use this Groupon. So we were looking around and stuff, and then my wife discovered a dragon model. And she has a thing for dragons. She likes to paint them. She painted, I think it was a Reaper mini dragon previously. It was like, I don't know, a young dragon or whatever. So she painted that, and I have pictures up on my Facebook page. But anyway, so she did that, and she wanted to paint something else. And she discovered, to me, it looks more like a drake than a dragon. And some people might say I'm splitting hairs, but it's a dragon for the Uncharted Seas game. And that's put out by the people who are doing Dystopian Wars. I can't remember the name of the company. It's like some sort of, I don't know, Greek hoplite or something like that. So my wife, you know, she picked out this model, the dragon model from the Enchanted Seas, and she wanted to paint it, and she wasn't sure what colors to use. Fortunately, I have a decent-sized collection of paints, mostly Games Workshop Sandcon paints, just because they're what's around, but also some of the Vallejo ones. So I, you know, used it as a teaching opportunity, I guess, and laid out all my paints, and I explained about foundation paints and base coating, and, you know, you need to prime your model, and how to highlight and dry brush and inks and all that kind of stuff. And so I have to go out and I actually have to pick up some more paints, but she decided on a color scheme and she's going to start working on it perhaps this coming weekend, I think, or by the time all of you are listening to this, 3 weekends ago, she will have started on it. And she enjoys doing it and she has a lot of fun. So I think it's like a nice way for her to decompress. She's not really a gamer, but I like it because it gives her a glimpse into all the craziness of gaming and helps her to understand a little bit why, you know, it costs so much to get some of the stuff that I get. This particular model, I mean, it was $12. It's a decent, I mean, it's a nice looking model, pretty well casted and stuff. So if we can spend $12 on a dragon to paint, then, I mean, we can spend $15 on a blister of Perry Miniatures American Colonial Militia, right?
I guess I'm not the one you're supposed to be convincing. So anyway.
That's true. In my head, it makes sense. I don't know if it makes sense anywhere else.
Very good. So, in addition to this, your black powder interest has moved into Osprey books as well, which is always good.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Osprey since I got into Wizards of the Coast War at Sea. And I used Osprey to, I think it was the new Vanguard series, I think, but I used it to learn more about the different types of ships, some of the histories of the individual ships, and to look at the paint schemes to see how well Wizards did in painting the units that they said, like, for example, they have, like, the Scharnhorst. Now, is this really what the Scharnhorst was supposed to look like? Did they use the right colors on the gun turrets for the aerial recognition, or did they mess it up? I mean, because they're trying to be historically accurate. So I did that, but I was never really a fan of any of the other series, like the Men-at-Arms series or the Campaign series. Thankfully, my work purchases quite a few of the Campaign series, so when I wanted to give Black Powder a try, I was, as readers of the blog will know, incredibly confused, and I guess I still am a little bit, with Black Powder, insofar as it is to create your force and assemble it, because I'm used to the whole, you know, GW metric of you get your codex or your army book, and it tells you, you know, you need to have one HQ, and he can be a hero or a lord if you do an X number of points, and then you also need so many troops, so then you need so many elites, and you need so many rear or whatever, and you got to fit them into your force organization chart, and then you figure out how many points it is per guy, and how you're going to equip them and stuff, and Black Powder is not like that at all, and it's, for me, coming from that other metric, it's very, very confusing. So I was like, well, you know, I need to figure out how many guys I'm going to get and what's an appropriate size. And of course, if I had sat down and actually read through the beginning of the book, instead of just flipping through it, looking for, okay, so where's the force org and all this, that I would have found what I needed. At the time, I did not do that. So clearly, cooler heads really do prevail. Mm. But what I ended up doing was I looked at work because I work in a library, and whatever, I don't know the answer to something, I go to the library, and 9 times out of 10, it pays off. But we had a bunch of Osprey books. I actually lifted them up now. I think I got like half a dozen of them. And they're all from the Campaign series. They're all ones that I could find dealing with the American Revolution. So we have one dealing with like Boston, another with Trenton and Princeton. We got Philadelphia in 77, New York in 76, Saratoga, Monmouth Courthouse, and then Quebec up in 1775. So I just kind of thumbed through to see if they gave any sort of indications on, you know, how many men were in a regiment and how many regiments were at the different battles. And
But a couple of questions for you, Jonathan. When you were in grade school, were you in grade school in the Boston area or were you in grade school when you were further south?
No, I was in grade school up here in Boston.
Okay. I mean, certainly your part of the world is very rich with this kind of history. I would have thought that certainly either in grade school or maybe junior high, just as points of kind of regional pride, you would have covered some of this material. Oh, did you cover any of that?
We talked about this at length. And I mean, in college, when I went to school at Northeastern University first before I transferred. And my concentration there was on colonial Northeastern American history.
Okay.
We didn't deal in numbers so much. We dealt more with causes and reasons and, like, all that kind of stuff, and that these things happened. It wasn't that, you know, 5,000 men came on such and such a date, and they formed, you know, X number of ranks and so many units under so-and-so's command and inflicted 400 counts. That wasn't... It wasn't an area of interest. Now it is, because now I want to know, you know, how many guys lined up, and did they do two ranks or three? And were they really equipped with socks that went that high? And, I mean, all the minutiae. Now, back then it was like, so why did we go to war, and could we have avoided it? And, you know, all that kind of, the socioeconomic kind of stuff that played into it, more so than the actual military organization and that sort of stuff.
That's very interesting, actually, because, I mean, I guess not even from coming from this part of the world, and certainly the notion of militia and the kind of historical notion of militia is certainly something, and I don't know whether other Australians or whether people in the, you know, other parts of the world would really take an interest in this kind of stuff. But it really was, I mean, I'm sure there are college courses that talk about the history of the War of Independence through to, I mean, really, I guess there's some elements of even the English Civil War in terms of moving from kind of guerrilla militia into the new model army and these kind of things, because all these paradigms played into the War of Independence, and also, I mean, played into future kind of militia organizations. So it would be a really interesting history course. And obviously there are, prior to even musket-related warfare, these techniques have been used previously. I'm trying to think of ancients, generals that used these kind of techniques. But certainly in the English Civil War, American War of Independence, up to, I mean, the contemporary conflicts, I think probably the, you know, whatever might be called the Taliban or these kind of things, use techniques that were present in all these kind of guerrilla wars. So it is very interesting. And it strikes me, particularly the idea of militia and the whole concept of what a militia looks like in terms of it just being relatively ragtag, and also in terms of the kind of equipment and these kind of things. It is interesting the way one realizes how much one knows about a topic. For example, when I was in the UK, it really taught me how little I knew about a wide variety of points of history, almost precisely for the reason that you were saying, that when you actually start reading about these things, you realize how little you know about them.
Yeah, I got to say, a lot of my, you know, collegiate experience pertaining to history, I really made a concerted effort to not study American history, because it's shoved down your throat nonstop when you're in, you know, in elementary and you're in middle school and then you're in high school. But they would only get so far. You'd be lucky if you got halfway through World War II. So you spent a lot of time on the American Civil War, a lot of time on the American Revolution. And I was like, you know, I've been there, I've done that. And I mean, granted, it's at a different level and a different level of understanding. But I really wanted to do more with elsewhere. So I took a lot of courses on studying German history, a lot of stuff with World War II, French history, areas that, like, I was not as familiar with, and, you know, I was trying to give myself a more rounded worldview. And obviously, as it comes to Black Powder, since I'm not doing Napoleonics, it doesn't really help me very much, but it gives me a chance, I guess, now for me to go back and learn some more stuff. I actually, just talking about Black Powder, I have to give Henry Hyde a huge round of applause, because I sent him this email when I was kind of crazy, and asked him...
When you had the zombie flu, is this the period you're talking about?
Well, yeah, generally. I sent him this email. I said, Henry, do you know what? I was basically saying, I'm in over my head. I don't really know what to do. I am so confused. You know these people. You've played Black Powder. You have experience. You're in the know. Can you give me any suggestions on what you would recommend for someone who is a reluctant painter, who wants to do some sort of force that will be easy to assemble, easy to paint, and where I can perhaps get models that, you know, aren't going to cost me payment for a house? And so he was so nice enough to send a reply back. Henry's a wonderful guy. But he sent this reply back, and, you know, he gave me a little jab in the ribs, so to speak. And he's like, you know, your question is as big as a ball of string is long. Where do I start and where do I end? But he gave me a list of manufacturers for models and suggestions, and he's the reason why I'm doing American Militia. He suggested, you know, no matter how badly you paint or whatever you do, they could look random and mixed up or whatever, they'll look like they're supposed to be that way, so it's not going to matter. And, I mean, eventually, I ended up going with the Perry brothers for the models, partly because I love the stuff they did with the Lord of the Rings, and I love the other models they've done for Games Workshop, but also because Henry gave them a couple thumbs up, and I looked at the stuff that they had, and for the scale of 28mm, I gotta say, they're really the best, and I don't think they're expensive. I know others say they're kind of pricey, but for what you get, I think it's a pretty good deal. So I have to give two thumbs up and a round of applause to Henry Hyde, because he really is a stand-up act. So if it wasn't for him, I probably would still be extra crazy in not knowing what I was doing with black powder.
Yeah, I think you probably, maybe you've forgotten this, sent me a similar email for the crazy flu period. Yeah, and my advice wasn't followed, so clearly you have more respect for Henry than you have for me. Anyway, moving on from this. So I guess I probably should talk, I mean, we're kind of mainly sticking on your week in war games, or maybe the past 3 weeks or whatever. But from my perspective, while I was pulling out the Black Powder rules, I also pulled out some other books. I was hoping to get a solo wargaming manual that references a fellow that Henry has a lot of respect for, and my mind's gone completely blank with regards to the fellow's name. Anyway, so while I was downstairs in my library, and I don't go down to my library as much as I used to, mainly because my wife has allowed me to put bookshelves in the bedroom. Ooh. And yes, it's all ending very rapidly. So I went down to the library and dusted off some books while I was getting the Black Powder rules. One thing that strikes me about the Black Powder rules is that a lot of the painted figures use the Kevin Dalymore method of painting, which is, from my perspective, a rather heavy-handed, heavy-lined method, but works very well if you have lots of figures to paint and you just want a general style. And the Bible associated with the Kevin Dalymore method of painting is Foundry Miniatures Painting and Modelling Guide by Kevin Dalymore, forward by Brian Ansell. And he's since released a more advanced painting guide, but I just stuck with this one. It gives relatively basic advice. It is the antithesis, really, of Games Workshop style in terms of washes and what have you. This is really applying paint to the figure on multiple occasions, multiple times, and really, I think it's a style that has worked very well for Mr. Dalymore. I've not actually seen anyone use this in reality. So my only knowledge of it is from actually seeing photographs of his work. But his work is pretty well omnipresent in the UK wargaming press, mainly, I think, in reaction, very heavy reaction to Games Workshop. But what you'll find through there is basically his style is based on kind of highlight leveling painting, where you are literally applying paint at every coat, not really wash-centric. And it is a technique. I'm just trying to find some. And there's a lot of general stuff that you'll get in most painting guides too, associated with just assembly and undercoating. A lot of brush technique stuff. But yeah, this was just a book that struck me looking at the black powder rules, because his techniques are used. In terms of painting guides, I have mixed feelings with regards to all of them. I have mixed feelings with regards to the Games Workshop stuff in particular. The Games Workshop stuff is just a broad surveying. I've always been a fan of Tammy Hayes' work, and Tammy is a personal friend of mine, which has always been a luxury, because she just takes painting to the nth degree. But she had a falling out with Games Workshop and worked for Doctor Who, I think, for a period of time. But anyway, so shout out to Tammy if she indeed listens to this rambling. But the other painting guide that I was going to recommend is Dark Sun Designs. I think they've only put out one of these, so it's the Painting Guide Volume 1. And the reason that I'm recommending this, which is rather, I don't know, self-centered perhaps, is that I actually own a couple of the figures that feature in the painting guide. But my friend Kirill Kanev, who I commissioned work from, both painting and also he's designed some figures for me way back in the day, and then provided me with molds and stuff. And Kirill comes from Moscow. He's an amazing painter. He's won multiple gold demons. He's won the Slayer sword. He's just a phenomenal fellow, and he goes through both on every level, in terms of drawing, in terms of just general painting, general basic techniques, discussions associated with rust and other things. This is if you're familiar with the kind of Cool Mini or Not forum, mm-hmm. This is very much of their, you know, he's basically one of their top five painters of all time.
And really, this is an amazing guide for folks who are interested in really just taking it to the next level, to the kind of Gold Demon standard. A lot of the techniques in here are far beyond anything I can do, but some of the Rust stuff I just think is phenomenal. There are a whole series of photographs of Rust, and a lot of this actually talk a little bit about another podcast I do is really part of the Model Rail Radio phenomena as well. We've had some amazing painters on that too, and they get most of their techniques actually from miniature wargaming, which is something I've tried to spearhead with Model Rail Radio. So we do occasionally get on miniature painters on Model Rail Radio to talk about a wide variety of both fast painting techniques and also detailed weathering techniques. The final book I found was Making Terrain and Buildings for Historical Wargames by Timothy Hall and Jonathan Sutherland. This was part of, I think, an Amazon purchase that I did maybe 2 or 3 years ago. There were a couple of wargaming books that were recommended. You know how they say on Amazon at the bottom, you know, you may be interested in buying such and such. Well, I thought, what the hey? I think they were probably $9 each. This one regularly retails for $29.95 US, but I think you can probably get it far cheaper on Amazon. And it's a wide variety of techniques, some of which I've used, and some of which I would use in model railroading as well as wargaming, associated with actually creating phenomenal scenery and building techniques. They've got various rock work, water work, all the kind of stuff that you need in a wargaming table, and just some amazing work. And there are a series of them, which I probably should have also brought up, by a fellow whose name escapes me, associated with period scenery, which is really fascinating. He's got one on the Second World War that I have. He has one on, I think, Napoleonics. And basically, he takes the surveying, both the photographs actually going to the locations and a wide variety of other techniques, and he creates these just amazing gaming tables and goes through a kind of step-by-step of how he actually creates them. And if I had my wits about me, I would have brought one of those up so I could have reviewed that as well. So maybe that will be for maybe the inaugural Monty and the Fox. In addition to this, as folks may remember, relatively ad nauseum, I have been working on a wargaming slash... You see, I use both the term wargaming and role-playing game because my feeling is that there is the opportunity for miniatures to come into play associated with this, and the skill set is almost lends itself to kind of small skirmish-style wargames as well. So if I use the crossover term, it's merely because my own thinking is the potential of going in both directions. A large portion of this is dealing with probability, and I think I had mused maybe on my solo cast or maybe another discussion about using D12s instead of D6s, and I've been interested basically in the play feel associated with that because I just think, you know, well, there are different play feels associated with using both kinds of dice. So I was on the iPhone App Store last night looking for some kind of dice simulation that could do what I was looking for relatively quickly. The first application I picked up, I think both of these were 99 cents, was Simple Dice by Nora Kraus. And unfortunately, the probability's wrong. I don't know why you would buy a dice simulator where your chance of rolling 100 on a D100 was probably about 1 in 20, but it just strikes me... I was going to leave a negative review on iTunes, but then I thought, no, all this comes back, so why not leave a negative review on the CWF Gamecast itself? And the other dice application I got was Dynamic Dice, which was okay, and Dynamic Dice actually enables you to put in whatever series of dice you want and roll them at random. The only thing I'll say about that is the dice come up in all kind of haphazard order, and in terms of speed rolling, which is really what I'm interested in, you basically have to be able to look quickly. You can lock the dice down, which is a good technique in terms of certainly taking the top three of four or taking the top two of three, which is a dynamic that I'm using rather heavily in the Field of Chaos role-playing game in order to get some of the more interesting probabilities. But again, I wasn't feeling it particularly. So dynamic dice gets a slightly higher score than simple dice. But yeah, I guess the perfect app just isn't out there for me currently, Jonathan, and it almost begs the question, as I'm releasing these rules also in an open source form, why I don't just write my own iPhone app with the actual rule set, which is probably what's going to happen in the long run. Anyway, so I think that's pretty well my week in wargaming. I did have a couple of books that I wanted to talk about as well from the last show, and I was going to pull them from my shelf, but unfortunately... Pick up the Black Powder rule set and the other related stuff got me into my library, which got me thumbing through a whole series of different books. But yeah, coming up in probably the next couple of weeks, I will have the basic
rules associated with this role-playing slash skirmish war game thing. And my hope is actually to use some of the folks who listen to this podcast as playtesters. But we'll probably come to that in a show or two's time. And certainly we have a contest running currently associated with something to do with that as well. What's the next topic of discussion? Do you want to talk about your appearance on Gatestormers?
Well, before we move on, I just want to mention a dice rolling app that you may not have looked into. It's one I use and I'm happy with. I'm not someone who's mathematically inclined, so I can't speak to the probabilities involved. But Dicenomicon receives a lot of positive reviews. I purchase it. I use it when I play in the monthly D&D game that I'm in. And it's an app that the DM has allowed me to use. He's normally someone who's not in favor of those kind of things because of, I guess he's concerned with possibly skewed results.
Yes.
But he seems to be content enough with it and feel that I'm not, you know, rolling any better than I should be or any worse.
How do you spell it? Dice, N-O-M, how do you spell it?
It's, I believe, Dice, N-O-M-I-C-O-N. It should all be one word, I believe. And it's, from what I understand, it's a highly rated app. It's very popular. It's, I don't know how much it actually goes for, if it's like 99 cents or $1.99 or what it is. I have it on the iPad, and I'm not...
The Dicenomicon. Here we go. It's $4.99.
Mm. Oh, there we go. Well, that's kind of pricey.
Okay, if it's recommended by Jonathan J. Reinhart, I will tell my wife that it was your recommend. Let me just have a look at one of these things. Let me see why it's worth the kind of money it's worth. Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
But apparently, I've liked it, and apparently it's supposed to be pretty good, so it's something for people to consider. I mean, that $4.99 price tag, that's, for an app, that's a lot of money.
That is. I think I might write my own, Jonathan. It does look very beautiful, but unfortunately, management probably wouldn't approve.
Yeah. You know what? You could probably write a better app. So
yeah, sadly so.
I think you should do that. And hey, then you can talk about your better app here on the podcast.
I'm into that. So, what else do we have in the general week of wargaming? So, why don't we talk about your appearance on Gatestormers?
Yeah, my friend Drew is running his own gaming blog and podcast. And he actually told me, and I think it's very flattering, but he said he kind of got the idea from listening to us here on the podcast and liking what we do. And he thought, you know, well, if Jonathan can do it and, you know, if people seem to like what they're doing, then maybe I can do my own blog and podcast. So I've been very supportive of him and his endeavor. He's had a lot of questions, and I think anyone who gets into anything new is going to have questions on how to do it. So he got it up and going, and then he needed someone to appear on his podcast. He wanted to get the first episode out, and sadly his co-host, I guess, has some other responsibilities right now, so he's kind of on a leave of absence. Mm-hmm. So it was Drew interviewing me, slash me kind of guest co-hosting, but we talked about, you know, gaming and 40K and just like all sorts of kind of different things, it was really nice to go. It's, as much as I love talking with you, Tom, it's like a different kind of atmosphere, I guess. So one thing I got to say about the Gatestormers, though, and I mention this every single time I talk about the Gatestormers, whether it's on our Facebook page or our blog or whatever, and it's just because it's not something that we do here, and I feel like if I was to listen to it and be surprised by this, then I would appreciate it. But it's I'm going to call it an explicit podcast in that, you know, it's okay if curse words appear or, you know, perhaps references that, you know, might not necessarily be work safe. So it's just something to keep in mind. It's not done for the sake of just doing it. It's, you know, just part of the atmosphere and it comes out. There was another...
Inquiring minds want to know. Does this mean that Jonathan J. Reinhart will actually be cursing in this podcast?
Well, it might mean I may have had a ding or two appear.
I'm very disappointed, as I'm sure the other listeners of the CWF podcast are.
Actually, do you know what, though? I do have a little bit of a conversation on there about the... To me, it's kind of absurd and ironic at the same time, but the naming of a particular GW Space Orc unit, giving the other connotations of the word in English, and the fact that they had done it, Drew decided that was because they felt it was in line with Space Orcs and their characteristics. I don't know if that's real or not, but I mean, that was perhaps as outside the box as I got on the show.
I'm going out of the way. I'm an Orc aficionado. I'm only thinking snake bites. Was it the snake bites? Which of the... I'm curious here.
Well, it's a particular type of orc who becomes a bodyguard, I guess, traditionally, before they...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I understand what you're talking about.
You know, they're a bigger, badder...
Yeah, orc. I understand. Yes. Okay.
But I just thought that was interesting. Drew, on the other hand, in, you know, future episodes...
You know what it's short for? It's short for noble.
I can't say I do, but I will go along with that.
Okay. Anyway, continue.
So, Drew, he's not going to pull any punches. He'll say like it is. And he's always been that way. It's just how it is. So if that's something that's not going to bother you, keep that in mind. And if it is going to bother you, keep it in mind. But there was another gaming podcast I had listened to once. And I found it on iTunes. They gave no warning whatsoever. There were F-bombs all over the place and this and that. And part of it felt like they were just doing it to do it, that there was no sort of actual reason behind it. It just was. And, you know, I felt they should have had some sort of warning on it or whatever, and that other podcast did not. So I just wanted to give people a heads up on this. But the Gatestormers is going to be dealing with New England Gaming. It deals a lot with Battleground Games and Hobbies and local stuff. He's done a couple of reviews on his website. He has actually a fantastic article on why you should pay where you play. And this is something I don't actually want to get into in this episode because I think we could spend an entire episode on it. But I talked about it a little bit on our blog, which actually has become the number one most commented on article on our blog. But
wow.
Drew does a fantastic job on really explaining why you really should go support your local community. I know it's really easy to go and shop online and say, hey, you know, I can get free shipping maybe and I'll save, you know, 10% or whatever. But like, if you have a local community that you support, that you like, that you go to, you really do need to support them with your money and however else you can. Because, I mean, they need it. And if you don't, and if, you know, your friends don't, and their friends don't, then these places are going to go away. And,
yeah.
I mean, for that simple reason, like, you just have to never mind the fact that I think whatever you put into it, you get more out of than you actually put in. And for those who are listening now and have read what I've written on the blog, you're going to notice some sort of disparity. And the reason for that is I used the blog article actually as a test case. I wanted to get more people to comment on the blog, and I'm not going to lie about it. There was just, you know, some promotion. I figure I put something up, you know, that's going to be controversial.
Benefaction controversy.
People reply. And then also I wanted to use this sort of reverse psychology to get people to realize that it is important to support where you go. So you really do have to support your local game store. So, and it seems to be working. People are very upset with me, and they're lining up saying, but you're wrong, you must support your local game store. Well, I agree with you. Of course, that didn't come across in the article. But anyway, so he has a wonderful article about that, and just all sorts of stuff. One thing I think is going to be fantastic on the Gatestormers, and I'm not sure if it's only going to be on the blog or if he's doing it on the podcast as well, and I'm hoping he does do it on the podcast, is he's calling it the Healthy Gamer, and it's one of his so-called projects where he's going to try to address how gamers can be more healthy. And, I mean, stereotypically, and I think sadly this is true, gamers are either overweight or underweight. And they don't have the best eating habits, they don't have the best habits in general. I mean,
In defense of this, however, in terms of the model rail community, I think the model rail community, although you're right, they are moving in the same direction. I've actually thought about doing exactly the same thing with Model Rail Radio, particularly because I give T-shirts away on Model Rail Radio. The number of 2X and 3X and 4X T-shirts I have to give away on Model Rail Radio, it gets kind of depressing. I mean, you get the sense that these people are really shortening their lives through their behaviors. And, yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I think that's a really good thing.
So I'm very excited about it. One of the things he's doing, he's going to address how you can eat healthy. Like, if you're entertaining gamers at your place of living and you're going to be playing there, meals you could do that are affordable, because Drew knows, I mean, times are tough now for everyone. But gamers in general probably don't have as much money, especially if you're in your 20s or younger. So he's trying to address that. And one way he's doing it is a mutual friend of ours is a certified chef. He graduated from Johnson & Wales. He works in the industry. So he has all this culinary knowledge, and he's going to be involved. I'm not sure if he's going to be involved in the podcast, like I said, but, you know, in the blog, coming up with recipes and stuff. And I actually think down the road they're going to try to do some hands-on workshops in the area for gamers who live nearby who want to come and, you know, learn how to make some of these recipes. They're not going to be, you know, difficult things, but not everyone has culinary skills. And, I mean, cooking classes are popular, so why not a cooking class for a gamer?
Very good. Very good. we didn't really have a main topic of discussion this week aside from Black Powder, but I'm doing the math, and I think the War at Sea contest may have actually officially already closed by the time this podcast comes out.
Yeah, by the time this comes out, it should have closed. That's why, I mean, we're recording it and there's still time, but that's why this weekend I kind of did a mini podcast episode, because I just wanted to give people a reminder of it. That hasn't yet resulted in more submissions, but that has resulted in more talk about the contest.
Pretty good.
Ends up
pretty
becoming
good.
Submissions.
And
By the time you're listening to this, it will be over. But to date, this will be the largest prize that we will have given out for a contest. It's about $60 worth of stuff, give or take a little bit. So, I mean, that's the most we've ever done. So it'd be nice for it to have been a success. And hopefully by the time you listen to it, you'll have read on Facebook and elsewhere that we're delighted by what had happened with it.
Very good, very good. So we do have another contest that's running currently. Jonathan, what is the name of that contest?
I feel like we have quite a few contests going on, so I think you need to remind me.
Uh-huh. So I floated what is now probably three episodes ago, maybe four episodes ago. I obviously just published this book, Field of Chaos, after probably a year and a half worth of work, but it's been about 17 years in since it came out. And there's a mysterious, maybe a listener to this podcast, but definitely a listener to my other podcast, Stone Ape, who did a phenomenally good job associated with the Wikipedia entry for Field of Chaos. It is, I went out to lunch with a friend today and we were talking about what it means to actually put out a book and to have a reader who can put together that kind of synopsis on Wikipedia and defend it against the Wikipedia fairies or whatever the term might be is just absolutely phenomenal. Anyway, so I put in this time for this book called Field of Chaos, of which there will be a role-playing slash skirmish-oriented game coming out in the very near future. The contest revolves around a thing called the Political Compass. And the Political Compass, as Jonathan has editorialized, well, actually he hasn't because he cut that audio, but anyway, the Political Compass is a little bit of fun, where you answer a few political-related questions, and then the Political Compass puts you in four perspective quadrants. And in order to enter this contest, you don't need to do anything aside from answer questions even flippantly. I don't care what you answer. I'm just interested in the four perspective quadrants, which are left libertarian, left authoritarian, right libertarian, right authoritarian. And just a random smattering from these various areas, as a listener to this very podcast, go to the Political Compass either on Facebook or online. Fill out the questions and let me know which of the four quadrants you are in. Email me directly, tom@noblape.com, noblape.com, or via Facebook, and let me know which of the four quadrants you are in. And each of the quadrants, a name will be selected at random, and they will receive a paperback copy of Field of Chaos sent wherever they are around the globe. And aside from that, I think that's the rules associated with that one. And my anticipation is, originally I had announced it for a conclusion at the start of May, but due to the editing time associated with all these episodes, I'm willing to push it to probably somewhere mid-June. When we kind of catch up associated with these podcasts, when the editing catches up with the time, we will get closer. But if you can just fill out the Political Compass questionnaire, let me know which quadrant you are in via email or Facebook, and I'll start collating those names. And it will be on par, actually, with the War at Sea contest. I mean, when you take postage into account, it is probably going to be more than about $60, that particular contest. The other thing that I need to talk about is the Monty and the Fox logo, because my wife is currently working three jobs, and I have been progressively reminding her about the Monty and the Fox logo. I will probably have to do the draft logo with her final approval. I'm actually doing some other graphic design stuff for her currently in that light as well. She has a relatively large backlog with me. I produce various things that need graphic design done for them, and Monty and the Fox is just one of those things. So what I've done to date is pull together some concept art pieces for her approval and fine-tuning, and my hope is that we will actually have a logo for this podcast
probably in the next couple of weeks with additional feedback from my wife. So that is the time frame. Hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, we will have a partially Tom Barbalay, partially Michelle Barbalay design Monty and the Fox logo. I'm running currently with a particular design, which is based on some abstract components of that. And once we get, maybe I'll do a couple. In fact, Jonathan, you probably should be part of this loop associated with this graphic design process too, since yeah, you're probably going to have to stand by this logo as well. Maybe even wear T-shirts or caps with the logo on it. So yeah, I will include you in the CC loop once I've had her basic approval, and we'll take it from there.
Well, I just have to say, well, I have three things I actually have to say. Regarding the Monty and the Fox name, I just need to make sure that I give a shout-out again to Graham and his son Nico, because they're the ones, although apparently Nico is the one who says he came up with the name, but they're the ones collectively together who came up with the name which we are adopting for our show. And so they were the winners of the, you know, Name Our Podcast contest. So I just want to give a big thank you to both of them again. I know they listened to it, and so I want to say thank you. And then also I want to say, for those of you who are unsure about whether or not to do the whole Political Compass Field of Chaos contest, it really takes next to no time to do the Political Compass. It's very easy. And I mean, obviously Tom wants you to do more than just click on buttons. We both want you to do more than just, you know, just click on your way down and, you know, put a little bit of effort into it, but it's not taking a whole lot of time, and it's kind of actually fun to do. I do it every 6 months, and it's just, I don't know why I do it every 6 months. It's just something I do. But I'm working my way through Field of Chaos. I may be, I want to say I'm halfway through, but I might be more than halfway through. And it's a very enjoyable read. It's worth picking up whether you're getting it for, you know, as a result of this contest, or if you're actually spending money on it, which, you know, I got to say, I think you should spend money on it because I'm enjoying it anyway. So I think it's something that you're going to enjoy. It's a nice story, and it's good. So I think it's...
So as you're only halfway through it, you can't be the person who's doing the Wikipedia entries then, unless you're saying that you're only halfway through it.
I know you've suspected that it was me for quite a while, and I got to say, I am nowhere near as talented enough to be able to deal with the Wikipedia administrators to keep an article in there. It's just not in my skill set.
Yeah, it's got to be a listener of Stone Ape. That's where my money is. I have a short list of people on Stone Ape. But yeah, phenomenal Wiki. In fact, really, if people are interested in working out what the book is about,
it's a good
Field of Chaos on Wikipedia, I've got to put my hats off to that, because, I mean, basically that describes it and finds a wide variety of links that, yeah. Anyway.
And actually, for, I mean, listeners of the show, we are listed as a reference, actually. I don't remember what, actually, that was one of our very recent episodes where we talked about Total Colin and your travels in the Bay Area.
Are we listed as a reference?
We are. Under references, of course, you're listed a bunch of times, and Heron is for Stone Ape and stuff. But number two reference, Jonathan J. Reinhardt, CWF Gamecast, Total Colin and Bay Area Travels, retrieved 3/17/2011. So some listener of Stone Ape, I think you're right, it's probably a Stone Ape person, but someone who listens to that is also listening to this.
You're right.
Bad
image. Oh, my goodness.
I get
Jonathan.
I find it fascinating. The article really is, I mean, whether or not I'm listed somewhere, it doesn't matter to me, but the Wikipedia article really is, it's very well done. It's piqued my interest in...
Yeah, it's funny because I'm at the point currently, I have a pile to send on to newspapers and magazines for review. And I was originally going to write a very brief cover letter, but I'm now thinking that I just need to print out a Wikipedia article. it is really, really phenomenal. And yeah, I've got to say, yeah, hats off to the individual who obviously listens to this podcast as well. I didn't even recall seeing that but you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. Okay.
I wish I could say that I was doing some sort of self-promotion, but it's not me.
Very good. Okay, so this has been the... in terms of editing, Jonathan, are you anticipating maybe releasing these slightly faster so we can catch up to real time, or are we always going to be 3 weeks?
I would love to release them slightly faster. I got to say, I'm almost completely caught up with episode, I guess it's 40, will be, or will have been... See, this is tough when you're recording now.
And this is episode 51.
Like, I'm just not sure about the tenses to use. And that's something actually. Yeah. It was an issue.
I will say, episode 50 was great fun to record, and shout outs to Stephen McLaughlin because I haven't finished the most recent lot with Pat and Do podcast, but he is a phenomenal fellow to record with, and I'm really looking forward to recording with Neil Shook, and I shouldn't say this, John. I mean, it's not like you all have enough fun to record with. I'm not saying it in that way. But my point about it is that, yeah, it was great fun to record with Stephen McLaughlin. I'm looking forward to also talking with Jonathan, also talking with Neil Shook and Henry Hyde. Coming up very shortly, my anticipation was to record with Neil Shook maybe this coming weekend. So I may have more. We may have yet another podcast to fit in the feed somewhere. Henry is harder to track down because he's currently organizing another release of Battle Games. But Neil is online pretty frequently.
I listen to our show, and as much as I love our show, and I think we're doing fantastic things, but when I listen to WWPD News from the Front, I mean, clearly there's a difference. I don't know if it's... Pirates equipment, obviously, but they're just fantastic at what they do. They really are. There's a reason why they're a huge success and a reason why they're going to continue to be. And then, obviously, Neil has been doing meeples and miniatures for, well, it feels like forever, in a good way. I mean, he has staying power, and you only get to stay around if you're really good, and he is, so clearly.
Yeah, I have a very good Neil Shook impersonation, and I know this is actually valid, because... For the earliest number of shows, he would whisper, and he constantly whispers in his podcast. So this is my Neil Shook impersonation. Anyway, the reason for that is that his son is sleeping in the room next door, so he literally has to whisper through large sections of his podcast. But anyway, that's a complete aside. We're digressing rapidly here, Jonathan. Your wife is leaving you to go to the library or something, so we probably should wrap this thing up.
Well, actually, do you know what? I'm going to skip out on the whole Boom Studios thing right now, because that's a lengthy conversation. But I wanted to mention one quick hit. The quick hit is in relation to Pandemic. I recently got another game of Pandemic in, and I'm 0 for 8. So,
how many people did you play with? I think this is the critical thing. Unless you play with 6 people, you're not going to win, Jonathan.
We played with 4 people.
You see?
Do you know what, though? Previously, when we played with 4 people, we were doing really good, and it just fell apart at the end. This time, I don't know if it's how we shuffled or someone stacked the deck or what it was, but from the beginning, we were doomed to failure from how things played out. We kept on getting cards that we shouldn't have been getting. I mean, it just fell apart from the beginning, and we would have played again, but we decided rather than give more time to losing in Pandemic, we were going to play Carcassonne. Which was great. It was the first time I've won in Carcassonne in something like 2 years. So that was actually a plus for me. But, I'm still striving for that elusive win in Pandemic. And when the day comes, I swear, I'll probably just give out some giveaways on the show to celebrate. I don't know what, but it's something about it's fun. And everyone, we introduced it to one or two new people, and they all loved it. But, I mean, it just kicks our behinds. So I don't know what it is. But we're hoping to... I don't know. We're just hoping to win. It's what it is.
So when I was in the Bay Area, I actually looked for zombie dice and couldn't find any zombie dice.
Really?
But I also understand that you had enough copies of zombie dice that there was a theory at some stage that you might actually send me a set of zombie dice.
Yeah, that's supposed to have been in the mail to you. It never arrived?
We never received the zombie dice.
Well, I think I have to do some looking into that, because as far as I know, it got sent out, but I will double check on that.
No, I certainly would have mentioned it if we'd received it, because, I was looking forward to playing them. I've been looking around for them, but, yeah, anyway.
Well, I got to say, I've talked about how fantastic zombie dice is. Recently, there was the Penny Arcade East Coast Convention, and local games for Battleground Games and Hobbies, which I love, had a booth there, and they had a pretty decent spot or whatever, and they were told by the people who organized the miniature gaming room that they had the best booth, and I think they're going to get a better location next year. But they brought a couple dozen copies of Zombie Dice, and they sold out on them the first day they were there within hours.
Oh, wow.
So it was hugely popular. And then there was some other Cthulhu dice, I think, was going pretty big as well. But zombie dice, they weren't sure how many to bring. I said, you know what, you could bring 50 or you could bring 100, and maybe you'll sell out, maybe you won't. I mean, there's really no way to tell. And so they brought what they brought. And I mean, I think still, I think they could have brought 50 or 100. I think they could have sold out of all of them. And you figure it's 13 a thing. So just think of the money that could go in on that. But I think that's a reasonable price for the game. So maybe it's just selling out in the Bay Area and elsewhere.
I think Bay Area is a very strange market because certainly, it was quite curious what they'd sold out of. War Games Illustrated in particular, I could never go... I mean, obviously they just sell out instantly, basically, when they come out. But in the discussion with Stephen, I am going to try and track down 282. I think it's coming out either this month or next month. And certainly I'll be considering... in fact, this may be... I've been thinking about the painting thing associated with getting painting studios involved. And I think some Viet Cong may be the make or break associated with the various painting studios. So, yeah, when the Viet Cong come out, I'll certainly be buying a box set and potentially dividing it in thirds and sending it to the various studios to see what comes back. Because, no, I'm really quite excited about the Vietnam rules, and I think particularly if the What Would Pan Do podcast will be having me on to do some accent stuff. In fact, I was listening to a podcast I recorded recently and just thought how much of an American I sounded like. I mean, I think I'm losing my accent here, Jonathan.
I think you are, too.
My accent will be lost by the time I'm on What Will Pan Do, and they'll all be anyway. So
I think that's all, as they say, the news worth reporting.
Yeah, that's a hard idiom to push with us, Jonathan. But keep on going, and I'm interested in your work on the next half dozen trousers. so that will be the update for next week, no doubt.
Yeah, hopefully tonight I'll be able to, you know, paint some shirts, perhaps, or maybe a pair of boots, if I'm lucky.
Yeah, you need to encourage your wife to actually start embracing the whole, the whole kind of militia wardrobe possibilities. I can see her painting bow ties and a wide variety of other things.
She likes to paint, and I think she's pretty good at it. I mean, she disagrees with me, but I think she's pretty good at it, and if she could sit down and... But she has this affinity for painting dragons, so I don't know if I can break her out of that.
Here's what you need to do. You need to create mock dragon heads out of plasticine, put them on your militia figures, and then once she's finished painting the bodies, just pull the heads off and discard them and place the head on the next militia figure. And yeah, it'll work. Little tails.
Could work, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, for those of you who go to our blog, you will see some pictures of not only the Perry Brothers militia that I have been working on, but you'll also see Flames of War objective marker that I spent 12 hours of my life painting. And I like how it came up, but anyway, so I will hopefully have, you know, more pictures up on the blog of my painting progress. And you'll be able to keep track on what I actually complete and, you know, keep me honest.
Very good, very good. Well, it's been another packed show of the CWF Gamecast, Jonathan.
Yeah, I don't know what, this must be something in the water.
I'm into that. And yeah, next week, no doubt, more rambling goodness.
Of course.
I'll talk to you then, Jonathan.
Have a good night.
See ya.
Bye. The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com. And contest sponsor, Battle Games Magazine, the spirit of wargaming, available at fine hobby shops throughout the United Kingdom and beyond. Subscribe online at www.battlegames.co.uk. This recording is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.